Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, acclaimed science fiction author John Scalzi discusses his recent book, The Kaju Preservation Society, with fellow award-winning science fiction writer Michi Trota. The following conversation originally took place May 15th, 2022, and was recorded live at the American Writers Festival.
Good afternoon. My name is Ivan Kane. I'm a founding board member of the American Writers Museum. Welcome all to the festival and to this event. Visions of the future have been a critical part of American writing since its inception. And the guest for this program is one of the most popular sci-fi writers of his generation, John Scalzi. John Scalzi's latest book, The Kaiju Preservation Society, looks at what happens when you discover that Godzilla is real. Existing in an alternative dimension, the boundary of which is thinner than you might think. The story has been called wildly inventive and sure to delight, and the author almost insufferably good at his craft. Scalzi's Old Man's War won him the Astounding Award for Best New Writer. His New York Times bestsellers include The Last Colony, Fuzzy Nation, Red Shirts, which is a 2013 Hugo Award winner for the best novel, and 2020's The Last Emperox. Material from his blog, Whatever, which can be found at whatever.scalzi.com, has earned two other Hugo Awards. He's here in conversation with Michi Trota, a writer, editor, and fire performer, I hope we hear more about that, who is a five-time Hugo Award winner, British Fantasy Award winner, Ignite Award finalist. She is the features editor of Prism, a former editor-in-chief of Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, and the first Filipina Hugo Award winner. Please give a round of applause for John and Michi.
It is on? Yeah.
It is on.
Wow. Okay.
And we're echoing.
Yes. I was not counting on doing this discussion in this gorgeous echo chamber.
I know. It's amazing, isn't it? I love it. And this dome, I need to get it for my house.
Don't you already have it? You have a five-necked guitar, John. Six-necked guitar. What is it nicknamed again?
It's called The Beast.
And now you want one of these. I think Chrissy might have something to say about
that. You know, so here's the funny thing, which is, of course, that The Beast is not my most ridiculous purchase of 2021, because I also bought a church. Which does have stained glass, so this would just be, part of the, continuation of a.
You're already a best-selling author, John. You don't have to work this hard at being extra. Speaking of extra, I mean, I read the book, and I, true to form, I finished it the day before.
Of course.
We were supposed to be doing this.
Of course.
It was a great and easy read, which is one of the things I love about your books.
Right.
But I really have to... Poop fruit.
So, in the world of the Kaiju Preservation Society, there's an alternate Earth, and the alternate Earth has a completely different biosphere than the Earth does, and most of the things that are in the Kaiju Earth are things that humans aren't necessarily going to be able to eat because the development of biology had no consideration for mammalian, food.
There are no mammals in this world.
There are no mammals except for the humans that come over. So basically, the number of things that they can eat is fairly small, and one of the things that they are able to eat is this fruit, which is called poop fruit because it looks like poop, and because the people who are naming things decided that poop fruit is what they wanted to call it. Now, the reason that I chose poop fruit, except, aside from the fact that I am 12 years old on the inside and poop fruit is funny to me, is also thinking about the sort of person who comes over to an alternate Earth to do science. They are going to have a certain attitude and a certain way of looking at the world. They are not going to be people who are going to be too fussy about what they are, you know, what they are calling things. They're going to call it like they see it. And in this particular case, they see it, it's like, this is poop fruit. It doesn't taste like poop, but it sure looks like poop. Now, I suppose if I wanted to go in and figure out what the scientific name of that would be, I would have to be like cropule something, 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 you know, make it all Latinized and stuff like that. But on a day-to-day basis, they're going to call it poop fruit.
I mean, for a book that is primarily about a group of scientists running together, and aside from the main character who, it's constantly pointed out, only has a master's. you have, like, so much about the book is written in really, like, layman's terms. You're not using a lot of scientific jargon.
Right.
There is a very congenial sort of like wink wink, we all know that the science here makes no sense whatsoever, so we're just going to acknowledge it and move on, which is one of the things that I think makes it really an accessible read. And I'm wondering how much of that was an intentional choice to like not dive into the science of it so much.
Well, so here's John Scalzi's patented secret for writing science fiction, which is don't over-explain. And the reason is that if you over-explain, some nerd is going to catch you up on this thing. You know, it doesn't matter what it is that you are trying to over-explain, there'll always be someone. It's not just me, right? There's that famous story that Larry Niven went to, was it MIT, after the publication of Ringworld.
Oh, no.
And all the engineers were there, were like, you know, your Ringworld doesn't actually make sense. It would be completely unstable the way that you wrote it. And then they started chanting, Ringworld is unstable. Ringworld is unstable. Right? And so he wrote an entire book called The Ringworld Engineers to get back at them, which is, speaking of extra, you know, is pretty wild. But, you know, but that... The lesson to take away from that is, rather than to go into great detail about how something works or doesn't work, you give just enough detail that for the average person it makes sense what you are saying, and then you don't over-explain from there, because then the nerds will be like, I wonder how that is. And they will think it up on their own, and the next time you see them at a convention or a signing, they're like, I think I know how this works. And they will lay it out for you, and you'll be like, that's amazing. That was almost exactly my thinking. Right?
Giving all your secrets away, John.
You know, I'm perfectly happy to give this secret away, because I think it makes, one, it makes sense, because part of writing is the conversation that you have as the author with the reader, right? You don't, and I personally don't like things that over-explain, because it's often more interesting for me in my own brain to think about how it might have come up. The part of the enjoyment is thinking about that rather than to have everything like completely detailed. And so for me, that would just be something I would recommend for all writers. Only go so far so that the readers can meet you halfway and they will be able to add something into the mix as well. But the other thing is also I'm not that smart, right? I'm just not. I mean, I don't mean that as I'm not a stupid person. I'm an intelligent person, but I'm not, let me put it this way, maybe not that smart, but I'm not that knowledgeable, right? There's only so much that I know about biology or physics or chemistry. And that frontier is very close to, you know, to the shore, so to speak. So any moment that I go a little bit over that, you know, I'm going to fall on my face. So I have to acknowledge my own limitations, and in acknowledging my own limitations of what I know about biology or physics or anything else, like I said, you have that opportunity to let other people fill in the gaps for you. So for me, the accessibility is both a intentional thing of I don't want people to get lost in the weeds of biology, but also I don't want to make an ass of myself in front of the biologists. Don't embarrass yourself in front of the biologists is always a good way to live.
Well, I do notice that you did actually give voice for those types of those fans who love getting into the science. because you do have scientific characters in there who are constantly yelling, that's not how this is supposed to work.
Sure, absolutely. Well, and as you mentioned, I mean, one of the things that you do when you have something that seems completely unreasonable is you mentioned, well, that seems absolutely unreasonable. One of the things that you have to confront if you're doing things with kaiju is you have to confront the square cube law. The square cube law dictates that there's only so large an animal can be in our gravity well, you know, in the atmosphere that we have and all these other things. You know, you can't have 30-foot spiders because they don't have lungs, right? They would suffocate. And of course, they also wouldn't be able to hold up the weight of their body because as the surface area doubles, the volume triples, right? That's our cubes. That's the square cube law. So as far as it goes, if you are walking around going, you know, we have 150-meter large creatures stomping about the world, in one of the chapters, it starts off with somebody pointing to the biologist and going, okay, say it, because you've been wanting to say it since you got here. And she's like, the square cube line, that they should all be dead. They should be a pile of goo and meat and not breathing. They just sit there and go, ooh.
That is every scientifically knowledgeable person reading the book up until that point.
Absolutely. And then, you know, and the answer that this person gives, that's not too much of a spoiler, is they reach over and they get this binder that is this big and they just thump it down on the table and be like, there's your answer. By the way, that's a pressy. It's not, you know, that's the short version. Go ahead and work on it. And so in the universe, it's like, this is how it is dealt with. I'm not going to over-explain it, but they acknowledge that the square cube law exists. And you have to confront and make your peace with the science that you already know. And, you know, there are ways you can get away with it, there's ways you can completely ignore it. Most kaiju films and entertainment just completely ignores it because there's not
movies.
Enough. Yeah, there's not enough time because it's movies, right? You know, nobody wants to stop the movie for 10 minutes while, you know, the scientist goes, let me explain how the square cube law works. Nobody wants that. But as far as it goes, but in a book, you have 100,000 words. So you can get into it just enough that the people who are going to sit there and look at you funny for the square cube law are like, all right, you've at least acknowledged it, fine. And then they can move on.
I mean, a lot of the scene that you described, actually, was one of the things that really, I think it's a really good example of something that you do throughout the book and that I've seen in some of your other writing. It's a very cinematic way of describing a scene. Like, I could very easily see so much of this book being easily translatable to a visual format, whether comics or, for the big screen.
Sure.
Because the way that you lay out this, there are all those cinematic moments of, like, you can hear the binder drop and hit the table. Or, you know, you have the, at this point, the Jurassic Park moment of seeing the kaiju. And I know that being a film critic was a large part of your development as a writer. So I'm wondering if that is something that has sort of seeped into your personal style of writing in describing scenes in a way that feels visual.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I'm 100% acknowledge is I was a film critic, professional film critic for a number of years, first with a newspaper, the Fresno Bee in Fresno, California. And then I did it off and on for various magazines and websites and stuff like that. And I wrote a couple of books about film as well. You don't watch 7 films a week, 5 to 10 films a week, usually about an average of 7, without some of that seeping through. I mean, basically my story school was watching movies and finding out what was working and what wasn't working and how it was working. And so absolutely the first published book of mine, Old Man's War, was written in 3-act structure, right? It's like you can see that, you know, that 3-act structure, which is a cinematic sort of story structure, is right there. So much of my books are in dialogue, you know, carries a lot of load, which again is a cinema thing. So absolutely when I'm writing, I tend to see things visually. You like, I see the room where they're having that conversation. I am, you know, when they go and they take a helicopter to go look at one of the kaiju for the first time, I'm absolutely blocking that out in my brain, like storyboarding how that works out so that I can move it along. And I think the thing is for me, that's just a very familiar and efficient and enjoyable way to tell a story. But I also think for a lot of what I do in science fiction, which is about making science fiction accessible, not just for people who have already read science fiction, but people who are new to it, people who want to try it out, people who have, you know, their experience of science fiction up to that point has not been literature, but has been film and TV, to give them a structure and feel that they can immediately get into. And so, as far as it goes, it is both a personal preference in terms of storytelling, and it is also absolutely an intentional thing in terms of developing this story with the intent of thinking about my writing as a commercial entity, right? Because I do both. I want to tell a really good story in the realm of science fiction that everybody who loves science fiction can enjoy. I also want to sell a ton of books because otherwise I don't eat.
You mean you're not writing just for the love of it, John? You expect money for your labor?
I know, it's just, it's a radical idea in a capitalist society that I should get paid for my work. But the thing about it is that I've never not acknowledged that part of my reason for writing is I want to be read. I want lots of people to read my books. Lots of people will buy the books as well. But ultimately, the aspect of, I don't want to say necessarily ego gratification, but ego gratification of being a storyteller is that I to write stories that are accessible and that get out there. Now, the thing about it is also, you know, this is not throwing shade on anybody who doesn't write the way I do, because that would be, one, obnoxious of me, and two, it would not be acknowledging that the world doesn't need every single story to be written in the same sort of way. That there is something to be said about super naughty, K-N-O-T-T-Y as opposed to N-A-U-G-H-T-Y, although that's fine too. Super naughty, complex, dense things that you really have to work at, that you really sort of bang your head against time and time again, go away from them frustrated and come back until you finally crack them and then you feel like you've accomplished something. That some of my favorite books are books that are like that, that I reread like 10 times before I finished them because it was just work to get through, but it was rewarding work. That said, I don't write those things. You know, I write this particular way, and it suits me sort of as a human being, and it also suits me in the way that I don't starve.
And that's actually a perfect lead into something I really was looking forward to talking to you about this book is kind of like the power and perspectives of pop culture and escapism and what that looks like for different people. Like the way that you described your book in the afterword, and I've seen you talk about this on Twitter, is calling it a pop song, mm-hmm. which, you know, I think that's a great analogy. Sure. That's what it feels like. It is light, it is fun to read, and it is a literal escapist tale. You wrote this story in the middle of a pandemic, yep. and amidst all of the political turmoil of the Trump administration, sure. and the election and the insurrection. And then you are talking about, like, so that's what the whole book feels like. The characters start right at the beginning of the pandemic, mm-hmm. and then the pandemic and the election and all of that is happening off-world,
yeah.
so to speak. So it feels like the book, in a lot of ways, is wish fulfillment. Like, sure. You literally have to go to another dimension to be able to escape from some of this. And while I appreciated that experience of being like, oh my God, that would have been great, I would definitely have said yes to go working for some mysterious organization and find out that I'm on a different version of Earth, and there are kaiju, and there's literally no way for me to talk to anybody back home because you can't just pull out your cell phone from another dimension.
Sure.
But one of the things that sort of jarred me was the idea that all of these folks are here. They're not all American. You know, there are definitely like folks that, you know, I think you have some characters from New Zealand, from like, how do you pronounce the name? Neve? It's pronounced Neve, right?
Neve.
Yeah. Love them. They were amazing. All of their angry, this is not how it's supposed to work, and I'm so upset by this.
Yeah.
But the fact that none of the characters really talked about wondering what was going on at home and worrying about their family, particularly folks from marginalized communities, that was something to me where it's like, I both appreciated and it also like struck this sort of weird note, because I cannot imagine even being on another planet far away from home with no way to talk to anybody. I might actually be more anxiety ridden about what was going on. So I'm wondering if you could talk about that choice a little bit to sort of acknowledge what's going on, but not really get into it.
But not dwell on it. For two reasons. First off, as I wrote in the afterwards to the book, if you've read it, then you know this. If not, I was meant to have written another completely different book in 2020, and I just failed miserably, partly because that other book that I describe it to people as, it's Das Boot in space, and for everybody that's under the age of 50, that means that it was a dark, gritty, claustrophobic, political, cynical thriller in space. And it turned out that 2020 was not the best year to try to be writing one of those. Beyond that, you know, along with being a film critic, I was also an opinion columnist, in my newspaper days. And of course, I've been writing whatever for 23 years. And I've basically trained myself to look at the events that are going on in the world and to be thinking about them with an eye toward writing them. And unfortunately, in 2020, if I was doing that, it just totally consumed me. The world was pulling focus. It made it very difficult to write. And inevitably, what that meant was I wasn't able to finish that other book. And so I ended up having to call my editor and just being, look, I can't do this book. And I know that it's due in 5 weeks, you know, but
at least it wasn't 2 weeks like Consuming Fire, John.
Right. But I just can't do it. And so he let me out of that. And then as soon as he did, kaiju just downloaded into my brain, and I then immediately emailed my editor going, hey, remember when I said I wasn't going to have that book to you? Give me 5 weeks, I'll get you something. And then 5 weeks later, that was kaiju. So part of it was just the rush of having this idea that popped into my head and producing it so fast that a lot of the complexity of that world that could have and maybe should have been examined sort of fell to the wayside. It's like I had this one story to tell and I was gonna stick to it. That said, I mean, one of the things that's fun to do about a world is to present it and then to let people talk about it in ways that you didn't expect. So for example, I do a thing where I absolutely resolutely did not want the Kaiju Preservation Society to be an American a non-governmental organization. It is a global NGO. There are other bases on other continents, and those are largely populated with people who are from other nations and are doing other things. Within the Tanaka base, as you say, there are people from Australia, there are people, from New Zealand, there are people from Canada, there are people from Nigeria, and Gabon. You know, I knew where these people were from, and I made sure that I had their, you know, the names of their, there's a half Laplander, half Inuit.
Oh, I missed that one.
Ridituk.
Ah.
So all over the world. So I knew that I wanted to have that. But one of the things that I could not particularly have interrogated was their relationship to what's going on in the world. Like, Americans had a whole bunch of anxiety in 2020. Certainly, you know, and everybody had anxiety for COVID. I was not knowledgeable enough to go and track down everybody's national anxieties. So I couldn't necessarily do that. But the other thing is that also it just didn't occur to me, you know, because part of me was just like, I'm focused on telling this particular story. So having you come back and be like, okay, for people of color, there are going to be some anxieties and you haven't addressed them. They'd be like, yeah, no, I didn't, because...
Then this is what I appreciate is that, you know, you're always, you will hear people talk about like, hey, some of the things that, you know, I wish you'd done
sure.
or what, you know, and whether or not, you know, you don't take it as a personal attack. That
no.
is always something that it's talking about art. And I always see your work come back the next time having taken those things into consideration.
Sure.
So it's all part of, as a writer, you know,
well, absolutely. And the other thing about it is one has to recognize that no matter what story you tell, there are going to be things that you're going to miss. There are going to be some things that you haven't acknowledged. There are going to be some things that you will have gotten wrong one way or the other. And when that happens, you can either double down and be a dickhead, or you can be like, okay, learn from it. And then when the sequel writes, you know, you write the sequel or any subsequent books, you don't make those same mistakes. You get to make all new mistakes and then correct from those. One of the things that I talked about when I wrote Lock-In, right? Lock-In was a book that I wrote in 2014. It was a novel about a pandemic, which these days, you know, is not as amusing
as
it used to be.
Oh, gosh, I forgot that was a pandemic.
Yeah,
oh,
it was a
Lord.
Pandemic. But the thing about it was that it centers on a community of disabled people, right? And I am not a physically disabled person in any way. One of the things that I acknowledged that was going to happen, I did research. I talked to friends who are, for example, in the deaf community and some of their issues there, so that I had some grounding for the issues in the Hayden community, which is my community. But I had to acknowledge that it's entirely possible that I would get some aspect of that community wrong in a way that disabled folks would be like, no, that's not how things have worked in our experience. And the way to deal with that is when they do that, be like, okay, tell me, you know, so that when I wrote Head On, which was the sequel, I wouldn't mess up in the same way. And that was actually part of my thinking about basically writing The Other. And part of that knowledge, it comes from many years ago, I had a Chicago area author and educator, Marianne Mohanraj, write a piece on my website about, you know, writing characters who aren't like you. And basically she's like, you need to do it. You're going to screw it up. And when you screw it up, acknowledge it and fix it and do it better next time. And I carried that knowledge and information into my writing for that and for my writing for everything. There are things that I just simply miss because it's not in my life experience. I can be either twitchy about it, or I can just be like, yeah, okay, that makes sense, and then move on. And it makes sense for me to acknowledge it and move on rather than to get pissy about it, because the side effect of getting pissy about when people say, in good faith, here's the thing that you did, acknowledge it, and, you know, is that you are telling them that their lived experience is trumped by your own need for your personal convenience, which is a hell of a thing to say, and not necessarily something that I want to say. I will say my brain is be like, why are you telling me how to write? You know, because I'm that guy. But then immediately I'm like, you know, I have to acknowledge that, in fact, I don't know everything. In fact, people have a lived experience that is different than mine. And that if they are telling me about it, they are doing it in the hope that I will actually listen. And one, that's nice that they actually think I might possibly listen as opposed to just being like, Scalzi, whatever, you know. And then second of all, if they are actually making the effort, despite the fact that, you know, that I could possibly just ignore them, maybe at least acknowledge that they're making the effort and see if what they're saying is something that I can use so that I'm less of a dick the next time.
I mean, that actually, that's really related to something that we were talking about the other night, which is you pointed out that it has been 10 years since you wrote Straight White Male, Lowest Difficulty Setting. And, I mean, you know, if we're talking about, there are so many, you know, once you mentioned that, look, thinking back about the book, there are things that you're actually going into in the book about the ways that privilege skews your perspectives and that in its worst form, it causes you to look at people as objects to be moved around for your convenience. And sure. I'm wondering if you could sort of like talk a little bit about, it's been 10 years since you've written it. Yeah. How has that sort of like made its way into your fiction and the things that you choose to write about?
Okay, so for context for people who don't know what we're talking about here, about 10 years ago, I wrote a piece where there's a thing that that white people, and particularly straight white dudes, have, where people will point out that they have in our society a rather significant amount of privilege. And as soon as the privilege word comes up, they immediately seize up. And it's like, my life is hard too. And so I was searching for a metaphor that didn't use the word privilege, that could possibly help explain it in a way that didn't feel immediately confrontational. And I talked about, you know, the world is a video game. And when you play on the straight white male setting, it's the lowest difficulty setting. Now, what that means is that your progress through the map is a little bit easier. The non-player characters treat you a little bit better, give you the shadow, you know, a little bit of a doubt. When you get, you know, loot crates, there's a little bit more in the loot crate. All of that sort of stuff. It doesn't mean that you still can't do poorly in the game. And it doesn't mean that other people who are playing on higher difficulty settings can't do better than you. It just means all things being equal, things are a little bit easier for you as you progress through the game of life than it is for people who are playing on other difficulty settings. For example, people of color, people who are LGBTQ, you know, people who have a disability of some sort or another, and so on and so forth. And it blew up all over the place. Right around, which was not really convenient for me because I was running the Nebula Weekend that when it
came out.
This
was when you were still president.
Yeah, it was when I was still president of
Science Fiction Fantasy Writers.
Yeah, but it went everywhere, and it's a metaphor that actually got used quite a lot. And so that was 2012. It's 2022 now, we're coming up in a couple of weeks on the 10-year anniversary of its thing, and I'm probably going to write a perspective on it because I don't know how to tell you this. You know, it hasn't changed for the better. You know, it's
really.
I don't know. So
you
not
don't
only
say.
Not only do you know straight white men still work at the lowest difficulty setting, but they are actively working to nerf every other group that is playing the game of life. Nerf, for people who don't play video games, is a term that basically means that you take their abilities and you make them less effective. You put barriers in front of them.
Oh, you mean like gerrymandering and voter restrictions.
Gerrymandering, voting restrictions, taking away bodily autonomy. You know, making it impossible in an educational setting to acknowledge certain groups, so on and so forth. And this is not just something that's just kind of happening. It is an active thing that's going on. And it is something that does come into my fiction because it's frustrating to me as a human. To that so many people who look like me and have the same, working on the same difficulty setting as me are actively working to make things more difficult for other people. But also, the worlds that we write in the fiction can and should reflect the worlds as it exists today. But also, it's an opportunity to say, here is the world as it should exist. In the world of the Kaiju Preservation Society, science is prized and valued. In the world of the Kaiju Preservation Society, people who are non-binary and trans are part of the crew. You know, when Neve is introduced as, as mentioned, this is Neve, they are a physicist. That's just part of the conversation, as opposed to, and now the entire story stops, go, look, here's this representation. The representation is part of the world. I write this world not only to reflect the world that I see, where I have so many friends who are trans and non-binary and queer in one way or another, but also the world that it should be, where people who are trans and non-binary and queer in one way or another are just there, doing their job and being what everybody else is being, and not having to fight every day to make their representation be acknowledged. It's acknowledged at a very sort of day-to-day level, in the same way that my gender, my ethnicity, my whatever is acknowledged and is part of the conversation. And again, there's lots of ways for me to get that wrong, and people will discuss it, and people will say, here's how he could do better, here's what he's doing wrong, and that's perfectly fine. But it's important for me to say, this is the world that I think we should be in. And it's just, like I said, it's just really frustrating for me, and partly because science fiction and fantasy, to go meta outside of the things that I've written and to talk about, we had this battle 5 years ago, right?
It seems like it happens every, yeah. Like there's a cycle and it just keeps.
It's a recurring cycle. And the thing that always gets me is with particularly like white supremacy or the fear of other voices and other viewpoints and all that sort of stuff, is it's just an acknowledgement over and over again of the relentless mediocrity that's being defended under the guise of white supremacy. You know what I mean? Like, the idea that everything that is, and I'm going to mess this up, but it's really something, that every time I see someone who is, clearly spouting white supremacist rhetoric, under all this illusion, they're just deeply, deeply awful, mediocre, terrible, just uninteresting, boring people, things, ideas, everything about it is just, there's nothing to it other than that sort of eternal cry of, why do I have to share my toys one way or another? And it's just frustrating to me that, when it happened in science fiction directly and people started, they tried to game the Hugos. It was just basically, and they gamed it with just such terrible stuff, that it was just an acknowledgement that they couldn't compete with the people with different experiences, the people with different stories, that they absolutely couldn't, and that they had to game it so that they didn't have to. That the argument was not that they were working on a level playing field, but that they had to destroy the field rather than to share it with people who were doing a much better job than they were presenting stories, making the stories count. And it was just, it was angrifying to me because, as someone who absolutely loves the fact that science fiction and fantasy has become as good it is as it ever has been because of the new perspectives, the new voices, the things that should have been there all along. It's just saying to them is like, you're just saying you can't compete with this. Like, I got nominated for a Hugo Award the same year that the third book of Nora's trilogy came out, right?
Yeah, it's N.K. Jemisin's The Broken Earth trilogy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I came in second to her. And you know what I felt about that? I was like, yeah, nope, that's about right, isn't it? You know, and that was the whole thing, is like, you know, I get to call myself a peer of Nora Jemisin, who is arguably the most significant science fiction writer in the last 20 or 30 years, and that's awesome. But to see everyone, all these people who are like years and years and years of saying, oh, she only got it because she's black, or she only got it because, you know, it's politically correct. It's like, no, she did get it because she's black, because she wrote a story that nobody who wasn't a black woman in the United States could possibly write, you know. But she wrote it, and that story was amazing, and it blew everything else that existed in that time frame out of the water. And to just minimize that by saying it's only because of this or because of this shows your own mediocrity, your own refusal to acknowledge the brilliance of this work, and your own just general shittiness as a human being. And so it frustrates me, because, you know, why do we have to keep fighting the same battle over and over and over and over again? And the answer is because some people are just mediocre as fuck.
Well, it's also really frustrating because, I mean, my first Hugo win was right in the middle of the Sad Rabid Puppies attempt to, you know, gain the Hugos, and I started becoming really, really active in science fiction fantasy. Like, I think I met you around that time, was right around when Gamergate was, you know, burning up the internet, and people, a lot of women, you know, a lot of queer folks, a lot of folks of color were getting literally harassed off the internet and out of their careers. But one of the things that, while I was, you know, I was thrilled with that Hugo win, I was not expecting at all. The thing that stinks about it is that not only is it, you know, the whole, like, they're trying to hold up their own mediocrity, it means that those of us who still manage to break through, who are celebrated, who are awarded, it doesn't just bump our careers up, it also literally paints a target.
Sure.
On us. And that is, like, one of the things that is incredibly frustrating, because it puts people who are already marginalized in this really tough spot of, like, well, you need visibility to grow your career, to, you know, so that your stories can, so that you can share your stories. Your stories are published, they're turned into games and whatever. But with that visibility comes a higher level of risk.
Yeah.
That is, that there are less resources or attention given to us to be able to manage, to be able to, like, navigate safely through those things.
Right.
And I think that's one of the things that I think is valuable about having those different perspectives, is that, you know, there are things that, you know, we had a conversation on that recently where you were talking about experiences that you had growing up and how that shaped your ability to, you know, threat assess, your ability to assess threat and this and that, and that's different from, you know, some of the things that I've grown up with and learning how to look around and understand what the people around me might want or need without thinking about it. They're both similar coping mechanisms, but they just come from different areas.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, at the end of the day, the other thing is, you know, one of the things that I talk about when I came into science fiction, that science fiction was designed for someone like me, right? Like, I came in with a military science fiction book called Old Man's War that was basically a Heinlein juvenile, but with old people in it. And people just went, stick it into my veins. That's what I want, more Heinlein. And so it was really, really well designed for someone like me to come into it. And I slid into science fiction and the science fiction fandom amazingly easily. Patrick Nielsen Hayden, who is my editor, tells this story where he talks about having me come to a convention in 2005. It was the Confusion Convention, which is in Detroit. And he says he started that convention being someone that nobody in the community knew. And by the end of the convention, he had been in the community since 1978, right? Which was just his way of saying that it was so, I was such a sort of almost like archetype of a science fiction writer that the world opened up for me. And one of the things that I've had to acknowledge is, you know, that that was, to use the word, that was a privilege that I had that was because of the way that science fiction and fantasy had been designed. There are other people who came into the science fiction fantasy world the same time as I did or later, who did not have that same sort of welcome, who had to fight tooth and nail, whose welcome into the world of science fiction and fantasy was negation, was harassment, was there's already one of you here.
I got one for you because the first, some of the first nerd groups that I started hanging around with in Chicago were, you know, because my husband is also a nerd, like we bonded over Buffy and comic books.
Sure.
And our first date was to an actual like Boston Comic Con. So he did all this work looking for, hey, we moved to Chicago, let's look for social groups to hook into. And he found some that were science fiction and fantasy fandom based, and he's like, this sounds perfect. There were definitely nice people there, but it was very clear to me that when we walked in, they assumed that I was there just because I was his girlfriend.
Right, exactly. And you see, this, and to get back to my own writing and to, you know, some of the stuff that I do, part of what I see my job as in science fiction, both as a writer and as a person in it, is to try to make the world, try to write the stuff that is accessible for everybody, but also creates the world that I want to see happen. With that, in the community, it's to do the same thing, is to make sure that the community that was so welcoming to me, that gave me so many opportunities and has put me into the place that I am now, becomes the place that offers that same welcome and opportunity to anyone, regardless of their, where they came in from or what they are doing within it. And it's not something, it's not something obviously that I'm going to be able to affect on my own. Do you know what I'm saying? But it is something that, to the extent that I'm a part of that community, that I can say, hey, this is actually an important thing. Hey, this is what we stand to benefit from by doing this. This is what we stand to lose when we don't. To be a person with privilege who says, everybody should have that, the privilege that was given to me just by walking through the door. And if I'm not doing that, and if I'm not trying to do that in the fiction that I'm doing, not in a heavy-handed sort of way, but just in a way of like, no, this is the way that the world should be. This is what we do in science fiction. We write the world as we want it to, where we want it to go, or at least warn where it could go if we don't. Then, accessible or not, I'm failing. So that's what I think my job is, to be accessible, to be welcoming to anyone who wants to read science fiction, and within that science fiction itself, do the work so that the next generation of writers and readers see themselves in my fiction and see themselves with a place in that community.
And even if you only have a master's degree,
even if I don't have,
you can still be part of the Kaiju Preservation Society.
Absolutely.
So I think we are down to just over 10 minutes. So we wanted to make sure we had enough time for audience questions. If there's anything you'd like to ask John or myself, the microphone is right up here. Just please come up and use the mic so we can actually hear you.
Yes.
Otherwise, I will start asking John about burritos.
Right. Burritos. One quick thing about the questions. One, if nobody asks questions, then we are going to just go ahead and continue talking. But the other thing is, when you do ask questions, make them single part questions. Put the questions in a form of a question and make them short so that we can address them and give other people time to ask questions as well. So go ahead. And while we're doing that, burritos.
So if you were actually going to create a burrito for a kaiju, what would go in the burrito?
I don't know. I mean, I think probably the entire all the protein in the Gulf of Mexico, probably. I mean, it's just because it would have to be very large. I remember when there was the 1997 Godzilla movie, which was otherwise not particularly good, but one of the things that they did to lure Godzilla in was just this massive pile of fish, right?
Wouldn't it have to be radioactive fish?
It wouldn't have to be radioactive fish, but it would be. But it at least acknowledged that it's like, you know, you want to bring someone in, give them some good food. Yes, go ahead.
If someone doesn't know your work, where would you like them to start in your body?
So actually, if you Google this, I said, what Scalzi novel should I read first? I actually have a document that talks about this, where I grade every single one of my novels in terms of first read accessibility. And the ones that I would actually recommend for people, there are four. Old Man's War is always a good one because basically that's, if you like it, you will like everything else that I write. If you don't like it, never read anything else of mine again because it's not going to get any better for you. But if you don't like military science fiction, then I would suggest Fuzzy Nation or Kaiju Preservation Society. And if you're a Star Trek nerd, then Red Shirts is the way to go. Next question.
How do you feel when you're writing, and why do you keep coming back to writing, besides the economic part?
So my writing process is basically put my butt in the chair, write 2,000 words a day, and then or until noon, and then take the rest of the day off, because I only have like 4 days of creativity a day, and then the rest of it I spend doing email. But the creative process for me is kind of, a lot of people outline, and I don't outline. I make it up as I go along. But the other thing that I enjoy about making it up as I go along is my brain just pops off on all these ideas that I'm like, oh, that's actually a good idea. And then, but since I only write 2,000 words a day, I'm not so collapsed at the end of the day that I can't write the next day. So kind of managing energy, creative energy, allowing, you know, the sidetracks to happen, and just kind of going with it and, you know, with the flow. Next question. So the question is, will the book that I abandoned actually ever happen? And the answer is maybe. The thing about it was the wrong book at the wrong time. But, you know, there's nothing to say that someday it might be the right time to write that particular book. I never say never. That said, I have no plans to go back to that book right away. I'm writing another completely different book, and then I have a couple other books that I have to do before that. So it's possible. It's possible. We'll see.
Are you working or planning on someday to do sequels to some of your standalone books, like Agent of the Stars or Fuzzy Nation? Which, yeah, I'd love to see sequels on those.
Am I thinking of sequels to them? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
So on my website, there's a document which is the canonical sequel FAQ. So if you Google that, that will tell you whether or not I'm planning a sequel for those things, because I get this question a lot. And the answer, again, is never say never. But at this point, the only things that I'm obliged to do a sequel for is I'm going to do another lock-in book, and I'm going to do another Old Man's War book. Beyond that, we'll see. People have been coming up to me like, there's going to be another kaiju book, right? And I'm like, yeah, we'll see. I mean, if Tor comes and says, we want you to write another kaiju book, here's a truckload of money, then yes, absolutely.
Hi. What are both of your thoughts on Hades being the first video game to win a Hugo Award?
Who? What?
Oh, I mean, I love the fact that there is, finally, a video game award. There's actually a Hugo Award to honor video games. It's about goddamn time. What I hope to see happening is that there will be a large variety of games, not just specific, like a very narrow range of games that is, that's considered for the Hugos. But if you want to see that happen, getting involved in Worldcon, getting involved in the Hugos is definitely a way to help progress, like, what you want to see honored, in those awards. And also, I will point out, the Nebula Awards also now honor video games writing as well.
That. And this will have to be the last question.
It's for Mr. Scalzi. I know this may be in your FAQs, but did Hollywood ever knock on your door to translate any of your films into movies or blockbuster movies?
So you're asking if any of his work is being adapted into a movie or show?
are these things that you can talk about, John?
So half of them I can talk about and half of them I can't. So Old Man's War is at Netflix. We just got a new script on that. If they like it, then we'll be able to announce things. If not, then they'll go for more revisions. The Interdependency series is also under development at one of the streamers. I can't tell which one at the moment. The Dispatcher has been announced as being optioned, and that's in process. There are a couple of other things that have been optioned that I can't talk about right at the moment. Kaiju has been optioned for television and is in development right now. And then Love, Death, and Robots, the new season, comes out next week. And I have a episode in that which is it features the three robot characters from season one. And that's, like I said, going to be out Friday. So if you subscribe to Netflix, go ahead and watch that. And if you don't subscribe to Netflix, don't tell them that you have someone else's password.
All right. And I think, actually, we have 3 minutes left, John. What do you want to talk about?
I don't know. What do you want to talk about? Wait, there was a little girl. Did you actually have a question that you wanted to ask? Because if you do, come up and ask.
We have 3 minutes.
We do have 3 minutes. And that will be the last question. Because I saw her walk back as soon as I said this was the last question. I was like, no, I've become a terrible person.
What interested you in science fiction?
What interested me in science fiction? So I read science fiction when I was a kid. So I had always been reading it. And that was something that when you start writing, you often write about, you write in the, about the things that you already have been reading. So science fiction was one of them. The other thing that I like about science fiction is that it is a genre where pretty much anything can happen, you know, that you get to imagine going to other planets or meeting other species of intelligent life or, you know, just imagining things that can't happen now in terms of technology or other things, but would be cool if they could happen. The other thing that I think is really interesting about science fiction, and we talked a little bit about this, is that you get to talk about the way that the world could be. You can also warn people about what happens if certain things go wrong. And you can imagine just infinite things that otherwise might not have a place in literature at all. And that's the coolest thing about science fiction for me, is that just anything can happen in it in a way that sometimes you can't do in any other sort of genre.
Yeah, I mean, all of that, yes. But I think also for me, science fiction and fantasy has a very, very personal connection, because my tate, my dad, and my mom were both very much into science fiction and fantasy. And those were some of the first stories that they ever read to me. Those were the first movies that we ever watched together. And because I lost them at a very young age, being part of science fiction and fantasy and getting to create those worlds, getting to talk about it, getting to use science fiction and fantasy to talk about, like you said, what things that are going on in a way that is more accessible, that makes me feel closer to them as well.
Okay, we have to stop now because I think there's another group of people coming up. But thank you so much.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Michi.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, a panel of writers discuss their contributions to the anthology The Future of Black, Afrofuturism, Black Comics, and Superhero Poetry, recorded live at the American Writers Festival. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.